G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Felt like Sunday, I must admit, when I woke up this morning, but it's not. It's Monday and Adam White is here, so it must be. Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning. Why did it feel like Sunday?
I don't know. I just, when I was...
Oh, that's a real setback.
Arising from my slumber, I just, oh, no, I might just... I don't know why my alarm's going off, but...
No, it's no good.
I've set it for the wrong day.
It's no good because for the entire week now, you'll feel like you're a day behind.
Oh, no, now I know it's Monday. It's all right.
Yeah, I'm telling you, subconsciously...
I'm pretty good now.
I'm telling you, it happens to me, and it happens to others, that when you get into your head, you're a day behind, you subconsciously feel like you're dragging the chain all week.
No, I'll be
so
right.
It's going to be a long week.
You'll watch me rally. And I'll be some sort of effort this week. Don't worry about that. It'll possibly be my best week of the year.
Really?
Yep.
Gee.
Possibly be my best week of the year.
Wow.
You've been up watching sport, haven't you?
How'd you know that?
I can tell it in your eyes. I can see it.
Yeah, I'm a bit tired. I wasn't really sort of forecasting a six-man playoff in Turkey. Finished about 2:30.
You're unwell. You're just unwell. You don't need to be seeing everything across the globe.
No, but I sort of got a bit fixated.
Were you financially invested in the playoff?
I was financially invested in the playoff.
Okay, well, there's your answer.
But that's beside the point.
Well, it's not.
No, but it was because I want to get back to it because we'll introduce our third member of the team because it is quite a good story.
Well, I want to find out how he's fared through the carnival. Our man, Scotty Gullen from the Herald Sun. He's the main man around here on a Monday morning. We love his work. He's back again. Scotland, good morning to you.
Morning, Daniel.
How are you going?
I'm actually glad it's over. I didn't think I'd say that. Oh, it's a hard yard. I compared it to a marathon. It is a marathon.
It is a marathon.
Because while you can say, oh, no, don't bet much today, it's ridiculous. It's 4 key days at the end of a month-long campaign, and you're either still got some energy or you haven't, and I completely hit the wall, the famous marathon wall, about race 7 or something on Saturday.
Was it Sevy Oak?
Oh, Sevy Oak. Seriously. Form turnarounds. Blinkers were off, maybe, but come on. So that was the end of that. I made a couple of other poor decisions. And then in the last race, I'm having like $5 each way bets just trying to chat. And it's embarrassing that you even say, you know, you're having on about 3 or 4 horses. Like, I don't do this.
Just to get a winner.
It was quite depressing. All in my lounge room, drinking by myself. Like, it had all the ticks of. You're in a lot of trouble. Reassess life. So, where are they racing today? No.
Benalla today.
Benalla. Oh, yeah, I love Benalla. No, I had a day off yesterday, so that's okay. It's done. I freshened up.
Had a day off. Good
had
for you.
Had a day off. Didn't even open the form guide.
How did you have a day off?
It was Ararat Cup. I actually watched the replay. No. I'm all good. But it's great.
Stealthy
fun.
Lucas.
Yes, Paul Pruska.
He's going well, Paul.
Surprise baby colours, too.
Well, was it?
That would have been better if, anyway, that's going over old ground. No, it's a lot of fun, but it has its challenges.
Well, you've got through.
As does watching golf in Turkey, which you and I would have no idea that they're playing golf in Turkey.
Well, I did know they were playing it. I caught a little bit of the action.
It doesn't sound like the fifth major to me.
It's
the sixth major.
No, it actually, in all seriousness,
it's a part of a swing?
It's part of the Rolex series. It's part of the playoff series on the European Tour.
Yeah, it's
so $2 million for first prize.
It's 2:30.
I won't.
Give me a snapshot, please.
I'll give you a snapshot.
Did I know anyone in the six in the playoff?
Tyrrell Hatton.
Yeah, maybe I've heard of him.
Tyrrell Hatton. I must confess, a lot of them were some of the younger rising stars on the European Tour.
Names we won't be familiar with.
You probably wouldn't be.
Our listeners.
But was it quite extraordinary because it was a six-man playoff. Now, that's the first time that's happened in 15 years. Six players finished on 20 under.
No, but I mean all go at the same time.
No,
on the
three,
same,
and three and then three. Yeah. So they all got onto the 18th tee, which was they just kept playing. It was a par 5. And they all got a number, 1 through to 6, and that determined the playing order. And it went to a fourth playoff hole.
So they just started dropping off one of
the they did. So they lost.
I should play as a six.
Yeah, no, that'd be hilarious. Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, well, they lost 3 in the first playoff hole. And then they went twice more with 3. And then an American guy, Kiyama, had a putt from about 6 feet to win and missed. And then he went out the next one. And then It was down to the end where ultimately Tyrrell Hatton, who chipped in the playoff just to stay alive, ultimately won it.
And this was all in darkness, you see.
Yeah, so what happened was that at his most spectacular golf course in Turkey, and they have lights, just because they have lights, and not because it was a day-night golf tournament, but they finished after the first playoff hole. John Paramore, who's the sort of the big rules man in Europe, got them together and said, "Look, do you want to keep going, or do you want to come back tomorrow?" And they all said, "No, let's have a go with the lights on." So they played the last couple of holes in floodlight, and it was quite amazing. It's the first time it's ever happened on the European Tour or the PGA Tour. In fact, any professional tour where there has been a winner determined by or under lights. There have been novelty sort of skins events and these sorts of things.
Was it like Optus Oval? Was it very dark?
No, it was pretty good. No. It came
up. Pockets of Princess Park?
It came up brilliantly on television. And I just reckon that this might start a thing of whether this could be done on a more regular basis.
Now, golf under lights?
Yep.
But you can't floodlight the whole course.
No, you can't. But I wonder
how
whether
do you do that?
Well, my personal view is I wonder whether it's something where they floodlight the last four or five holes and they, you know, hit off at 5 o'clock or something like that on the final round. Let's do something like that. I mean, I think golf needs to do different things, and we're seeing a few different formats.
I don't know.
Well, I know the golfers won't like it because of depth perception and they can't see the line and all this sort of business, but I tell you what, it looked very good on television, and I reckon there'll be a lot of people out there thinking, "Oh, should we be trying this?"
Oh, I don't know.
So this guy, Matthias Schwab, missed a putt to stay on the playoff hole, missed it by about 5 feet. Matthias Schwab is one of the best young players coming through from Austria. Anyway, the difference between winning the playoff and losing the playoff was $1.5 million. So because there were so many in the playoff, $2 million to win, and if you didn't win, you all got $500,000.
That's a fair gap.
Yeah.
This is how it unfolded, Scotty. I want you to picture. I want
close
you to
your
picture,
eyes.
A picture. Okay. A beautiful golf course. Floodlights. Six down to two, and then this.
Schwab misses, and it's Tyrrell Hatton is your champion of the Turkish Airlines Open. Wins his second Rolex Series event in dramatic fashion. Surprisingly, with a par. What an amazing accomplishment. Hatton didn't drive the ball well, fought hard all day, did some special things in the playoff, chipped in for a birdie four the first playoff hole to keep himself in it.
Look at the drama. Can you feel it?
I can't sense the lights.
But
you had my eyes closed. I was confused.
Well, I'm going to... Now, seriously, it was history made last night.
Why?
What else?
Because they played under the lights.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right. Come back there.
I'll show you some footage.
No, we'll
be right.
No, I'm keen to see that.
2:30 in the morning.
Did you win your money?
I did.
Oh, no wonder we're getting
so animated. Hence the enthusiasm.
Oh, the story.
Someone in this studio may have taken the 30-1 on the winner, Tyrrell Hatton, at halfway.
Well,
it wasn't you and me, Scotty. We know
how
that.
Far behind was he?
And Craig doesn't bet on golf.
67 behind.
No, that's worth staying up for.
Well, if you got 30s.
Well, I'd gone to sleep. 30. I'd gone to bed earlier on in the evening and got up.
Oh, very impressive.
Do you bring a torch if you snap hook off the SMS?
Did you know that they... Yeah, that's from Eyes, who... I'm not surprised that that sort of jocularity has come to the table early in the morning. Didn't you know that back in the day, they used to have these nights, footy clubs and cricket clubs, where they would go out and play night golf with glowing golf balls?
Yes, but they never caught on the glowing golf balls because they had to insert the glow stick, and they didn't fly right. That's why night golf never took off. It affected the balance of the ball, or the way the ball orbited.
Right.
It had some issues. John Huggins going to join us as well, European golf journo, who was there. So you and he can have a great chat about that.
On air or off air? Is that going to happen? John and
Adam. We might start on air.
John Huggins is one of the most...
Then it'll go into the podcast.
The world.
Well, that'll be a podcast.
We might. We might install that in.
He and Clates work a treat together. Huggy. Huggy and Clates.
Don't take the mickey. This is very serious.
I know John Hagger. I've worked with John before.
This is very serious.
Well, it's good. It's good. We can't wait. We'll talk about that shortly. Just on, while we're on golf, we had the captain's picks from, we spoke about the Australian, not the Australian, the international team selections last week with Adam Hadwin and Sungjae Kim and Joaquin Neiman along with Jason Day to add to the international team. Tiger, we haven't spoken about Tiger's acquisitions for the US team. Funnily enough, Scotty snuck himself in.
No, well done.
Which is good for business.
To his credit, he did win a tournament before he declared it, which I liked. So there's no...
Yeah, I wouldn't...
No one could say, oh, you're just looking after yourself.
I wouldn't have thought there'd be too many people saying, oh, it's not the right call, big fella.
Well, he had to play anyway, but the fact that he won and then picked himself is
that, that's helpful. Tony Finau, Patrick Reed, and Gary Woodland, US Open winner.
Fairly
Gary Woodland.
Strong. Just shows how good their depth is, that they're extra four of them.
Fairly strong, but they won't play well here.
So US Masters winner and the US Open winner just get put into the...
Yeah, the afterthoughts.
...the wild cards.
Do you think Tony Finau will... dislocate his ankle and on one of the holes and then just recover again like he did in the Masters Par 3 tournament?
Mm, gee, it's going to be a strong...
The internationals need to get out here early.
We only need... But I'm saying this is what I love about the team golf. You only need to be hot for a streak and it's you're in the game. You don't have to worry about 72 holes. It's just streak golf. You just need to be streaky in the team golf format. And that's why the internationals are in it up to their eyeballs.
No, they will be.
Can't wait.
It'll be fantastic.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
I think people will be looking forward to going and seeing the best players in the world play, or some of the best players in the world play. I think the idea of winning is almost irrelevant.
But we're barracking for them. We'll emotionally invest.
But most people that will go to the President's Cup will go to see the best players in the world play golf. It's like the Fed Cup, which we'll obviously talk about in a minute. There was emotional attachment to that. People desperately wanted Australia to win, and that's why Australia lost, because they couldn't cope with that. But when it comes to the President's Cup, I think it will just be about two things, just enjoying the good golf and keeping the fanatics out.
We need Sunday.
Those two things can happen, we'll be going pretty well.
We don't want to make down coming into the last day and needing miracles. You need it to be a competition on the Sunday.
That, I think that's a bonus.
No, it needs to.
No, it absolutely needs to.
It needs to have. Otherwise, American win.
Yeah, there's got to be some level of competition going into the last
day. Going to the last day.
If it's curtains by then, it's...
Oh, no, I'm not denying that. I'm saying people that get their tickets to go...
will go early.
...are going just to see the players play, not necessarily to see the international team win.
Oh, I know.
It'd be barracking more for Americans to lose than for the internationals to win.
No, we understand that, but there needs to be, for the tournament to really succeed, there needs to be an element of competition.
Yeah, no, I don't deny that.
And if they have to manipulate the results, that's fine. Do the right thing. Get the punters. It's going to be 28 today.
Yeah,
I did that creeping.
I've dressed really inappropriately.
Outside, it looks... Is it lighter earlier now, too? Have I missed something?
And it was busy on the road today, too. Very early in the morning.
Something's changed. So after Melbourne Cove, everything just goes weird.
But apparently the rest of the week is a bit garbage. Tony Bowden will tell us more about that through the morning on the news, because he's doing a hell of a job as always. Some news for Whitey. The Fanatics will be at the President's Cup, which is what we all want. Lead the charge.
Where did that come from?
I can tell you. That's what's happening. The Fanatics website.
They're gathering troops.
The what website?
The Fanatics website.
They've got a website.
My word, they have. They have.
Following.
They're a travelling beast.
Thousands.
Across the globe.
See how much it means to all of us, and yeah, obviously it's bitterly disappointing to be sitting here not with the result that we're after, but all in all it's about taking a little bit of perspective, and this team, this group of girls, I wouldn't want to be sitting here with anyone else. It's been an amazing journey, amazing time of the year for us, and to be able to be in a Fed Cup final is something that is very precious. We'll cherish it, and it will drive us more for next year.
Ash Barty, after the loss in Perth last night, as France took out the Fed Cup final 3-2, we got off to a pretty ordinary start. We levelled it up, and then it was all downhill from there, apart from Isla Tomljanovic's fourth rubber, where she performed magnificently after melting in the first one. It was a good performance. We'll talk more tennis shortly, because John Huggan has been good enough to join us to talk about the Turkish Opens performance overnight.
the six-man playoff finishing under lights, golf at its best. John, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
We are very well, thank you. Appreciate your time. Have you ever seen anything like that, the way it finished overnight?
Not really, no. I mean, I think it's almost 17 years since they had a six-man playoff on the European Tour, and it's certainly the first one that finished under lights in my experience.
Did you like the fact that it did finish under lights and the experience that came with that for the not only the viewing public but for the galleries as well?
Well, yeah, it's great for the spectators, but safe to say it was their only option to get the thing finished tonight. It was getting pretty dark by the time they finished. And I did have slight misgivings about the floodlights, in that the depth perception is a little bit different when you're under a floodlight as opposed to daylight, but these guys are professionals. They should be able to cope with that.
Well, is there any chat, John, that they would hang it over till the Monday morning and finish it there? We have seen some occasions through golf through the last couple of years when weather intervened and they had to finish on a Monday. Why would they not consider that in this situation?
Well, they announced pretty much straight away that they were going to just keep playing the 18th hole over and over until they found a winner. And when we asked why that was, they said, well, we're going to put the floodlights on. So they obviously had it planned. I think they knew that if it went beyond maybe two holes that the floodlights were going to be needed, and that's exactly what happened.
It's an extraordinary place. Now, you're obviously there, John. Can you explain a little bit about it? Because the golf course has got these amazing trees, and as I said last week, it's a golf course Mike Clayton probably wouldn't like, but it is an incredible place with all these floodlights throughout the entire course, pretty much.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a massive resort that we're in the middle of. There's about, I'm not sure how many courses there are, at least four or five in the vicinity. So it's where people come, they come for a week. There was a bunch of guys from my hometown in Scotland. I bumped into them this afternoon. They're here until Friday, and they're going to play, I think, a different course every day. So that's the kind of place it is. You come here and you play golf and you get a nice variety.
So what was the atmosphere like? We were talking about this before the break, before you came on, about it looked good on television. And I just wonder whether as golf tries these new things, new formats to sort of engage potentially with some of the younger audience, whether there's something in this moving forward of playing under lights?
Well, it's been done before. I think Tiger played a couple of exhibition-type things back in the day under lights in America. So it's not 100% new, but it's certainly something that golf should certainly investigate every possibility. I mean, my goodness, the game is supposedly shrinking all over the world, so anything they can do to, get new audiences involved is going to be a good thing.
Did it look good if you're around the 18th hole, looking back down towards the tee?
Yeah, I mean, there was a good atmosphere. I mean, there was a good crowd. There's more. I've been to this tournament a few times, and this was the biggest crowd I've ever seen. So in that sense, it was a step in the right direction. But the atmosphere was terrific. The people were into it, and I think this it's easy to poo-poo people playing the same hole over and over, but it was actually quite exciting because it was a par five that they could reach in two if they hit the fairway, and so it came down. There's lots of drama. It was I found it pretty exciting, to be honest.
John, did they consider going all in the six tee off at once and playing a group of six?
Yeah, I would have been happier if they'd done that. There's something that's not quite 100% fair, especially for the guys in the second three ball. The guys in the first three have obviously got the chance to set the tone, if you like, and make a three or a four, and the other guys have then got to match it. I think it'd be, if I'd been involved in that playoff, I would have wanted to be in the first three rather than the second three. I think they've got an edge, definitely.
And just one final one, John. Well, I was trying to explain to the guys before about the Rolex series and the sort of money that's involved now in the European Tour. This is obviously part of the playoffs. It's the Nedbank next week before going to Dubai. Do you feel that it's working?
It's yes and no. They haven't. I mean, I wrote a piece earlier this week while I was here, probably that didn't go down too well with the European Tour, but pointing out the number of guys who are not here. And even Justin Rhodes, who won this tournament last 2 years, he was here, but he had to be paid to come despite the fact that there's a $7 million purse. So, but that's the world we live in, unfortunately. The top guys, they only go where, they've been paid to go. It might actually have been a better idea for the European Tour to make these tournaments $5 million instead of $7 million and use the extra $2 million to guarantee the presence of Rory McIlroy and John Rahm and all the rest of them.
It's interesting.
Yeah, something to think about for the tour coordinators going forward. But drama overnight, golf under lights and a six-man playoff. It was nice to be able to chat to you about it, John. Appreciate your time.
No problem, anytime.
Good stuff. John Huggan, one of the best golf journos on the planet, there at the Turkish Open, where Whitey was up till 2:30 watching the winner. Tyrrell Hatton get the job done in a six-man playoff. I, upon reflection, and we didn't flesh this out much before, I think that is, you have to play a six.
Oh, of course.
Have to play a six. Not only for
hence
the drama.
My very good question.
A terrific question.
Well, advantage, you know, the wind might have blown for that 3 minutes on that hole, then it stops.
Oh, no, it was a massive advantage going first because, without going too much into too much detail, one of the blokes in the first group hit the ball in the bush. Couldn't find it, and there was this massive delay. The blokes had been staying on the tee for nearly half an hour before they played, and a couple of them hit the ball way out to the right.
That's
and,
very funny.
Yeah,
he failed to mention that earlier when he was pumping this up, Daniel.
It's because it was dark.
They lost it because it just dribbled off the fairway.
No, that's incorrect.
It was that dark. It was
pitch black.
Anyway, I enjoyed it. All right,
the miners' lamp.
I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
They had hats on with those things.
And next week they're at the Nedbank. And the Nedbank, as you know, Daniel, is in my top six favorite golf tournaments of the year.
What are the other five, just by the way?
Well, the majors,
yeah, and
then Wentworth, and then this one.
Okay, no love for Turkey. I thought Turkey might.
Well,
have
that would be in the top 15.
15. Wow.
You love a list. I don't think I've ever met a man who loves a list more. Unfortunately, Australia aren't on the Fed Cup list for winners this year after being defeated 3-2 last night by France. Had a chance to end a 45-year drought. Wasn't to be. We had the team to do it, but it didn't happen. Why?
What happened here? I missed this. It was on one of those silly channels, and I was a bit late to the party.
What moved, yeah.
Pun, party, party, etc.
I think it might have been.
So Ash is in world number one and a great doubles player. What happened in the doubles?
Well, the doubles we never looked like. Well, we got won the first two games and we sort of looked okay. But then after that, it was all France. Mladenovic is how they pronounced it a few times last night. I don't know how to pronounce
that really quickly.
Mladenovic and Garcia were very, very good. I don't think Sam was at her best last night in the doubles, and they seemed to target. The French pair seemed to target.
Tactics. Sam? Just hit the ball to the other person.
That was my very uneducated view of what was going on there.
Well, let's cut to the chase. Unfortunately for Australia, Ash Barty didn't handle the moment. And she has all year, and she's the number one player in the world, and she has been absolutely brilliant. But unfortunately, she just didn't play very well against Mladenovic. She just didn't. And it should never have got as close as it did. And, you know, she
first
set,
6-2.
Yeah, but she was tight. She got tight. She got really tight. She missed a lot of forehands. She didn't hit through the court the way she normally would. The variation wasn't there. She just got tight. And unfortunately, when we got into a double situation, we knew that Sam Stosur was going to get tight because she always does. In front of her home crowd, but the damage was done that unfortunately Ash couldn't do what she needed to do.
But you said that she got us back square with a win over Caroline Garcia after Alia had some issues in the first rubber, but her performance in the second
could be
rubber,
career defining.
To Pauline Parmentier, where she won 6-4, 7-5.
Career defining.
Oh well, I hope it is because she had all the pressure in the world 100%. On her shoulders.
Mark Philippoussis style.
All the pressure in the world on her shoulders, and she showed a hell of a lot of metal.
She did. No, I think I hope that doesn't get lost in the wash. What she did because she, as you said earlier on, she got whacked on the first day. And fair play to Alicia Molik for backing her in. They could have easily gone to someone else, but they said, no, we'll back you in. You're going to be better second up. And she was. But again, Ashley Barty is now the number one player in the world. Mladenovic is about 40.
40.
And she has been a former top 10 player, but really,
she's pretty good.
If Ash played to her level, that would have been done and dusted.
So she played some dirty pool tactics, sort of time delays and wasting, and Ash got a bit annoyed by all that. Was it what was happening? Just to try and get her off the game?
I think when you are feeling the moment, you do tend to start to worry about those sorts of things because that's something that Ash does really well. That stuff doesn't usually bother her. Now, look, maybe if she won, Tomljanovic, she would have had all the pressure on her, and maybe she wouldn't have won, you know, the reverse singles. But it just came from nowhere because she won six love. Ash
best game of her career,
day.
She said.
Yeah, and it just wasn't there.
Mladenovic was the standout player for the tie.
That'll sort of punctuate her career.
She was magnificent. A win away from home. She led the charge magnificently in France. Walk away with the Fed Cup and Aussies. Nine in a row. Nine straight final defeats. Is that right? In the Fed Cup. That's what I read today earlier. That's a setback. We need to step up.
Oh, it's been a while. 40-odd years.
45 years, yeah.
You know, I kept thinking watching it.
And it changes next year, though, doesn't it? The format.
No, doesn't the men.
Isn't the women?
Women might as well. I'm not sure.
Women's changing.
I just kept thinking about how good it was, the atmosphere, and you know, you cared for tennis and all that sort of stuff, and Davis Cup are giving that up.
They are. Oh, I must admit, I was thinking that myself when I was watching it all unfold there at the Rack Arena. Is that the Rack Arena or the RAC Arena? I'm not sure. Anyway, it was in Perth. RAC.
Rank Arena.
Rank Arena, the 32-centimetre Rank Arena TV. Everyone loved that. Everyone had a Rank Arena.
Can I be a smart aleck?
Yes.
It's 34 centimetres. It's definitely 34.
You would know that. You would know
32,
that.
It was 34. And you'd measure it from diagonal corner to corner.
That. Well, we know that. That's how you measure any telly. Yeah. 55-inch these days. Or
I was correct again.
What do you mean you're correct, Scotty?
Fed Cup changing next year. Six-day tournament in April with 12 teams playing for $18 million prize money on clay. That's it.
Yeah, oh, and this is the whole issue.
That was our chance.
Good cash, though, suddenly.
John Huggan talked about this, about golf, same with tennis. The reason they're changing is because the tennis players won't play, because when you play Fed Cup or you play Davis Cup, you don't play for money. And so they go, oh, we're not interested in playing that.
Money talks.
No, I don't know about that.
What do you mean?
I don't know about that. No, money talks, but on. I don't know about that format.
That format sucks.
No, I'm not.
In April, come together for a week and that's it. No more team tennis.
But they'll play that because, it's a week and we get to play for $20 million.
And that's it.
And I'm okay with that. If I was playing, I'd be okay with that.
But like one thing for the year.
Yeah, that's it.
This has been a progressive thing throughout the year. You look forward to the next round. And
yep.
But unfortunately, women and men, it hasn't been working because the good players just don't play enough. So it's all right for us to get down our, you know, talk about it here in Australia, but around the world, the good players don't play.
John Huggan has been good enough to join us to talk about the Turkish Open's performance overnight. The six-man playoff finishing under lights, golf at its best. John, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
We are very well, thank you. Appreciate your time. Have you ever seen anything like that, the way it finished overnight?
Not really, no. I mean, I think it's almost 17 years since they had a six-man playoff on the European Tour, and it's certainly the first one that finished under lights in my experience.
Did you like the fact that it did finish under lights and the experience that came with that for not only the viewing public, but for the galleries as well?
Well, yeah, it's great for the spectators, but it was their only option to get the thing finished tonight. It was getting pretty dark by the time they finished. And I did have slight misgivings about the floodlights, in that the depth perception is a little bit different when you're under a floodlight as opposed to daylight. But these guys are professionals. They should be able to cope with that.
Well, is there any chat, John, that they would hang it over till the Monday morning and finish it there? We have seen some occasions through golf through the last couple of years when weather intervened and they had to finish on a Monday. Why would they not consider that in this situation?
Well, they announced pretty much straight away that they were going to just keep playing the 18th hole over and over until they found a winner. And when we asked why that was, they said, well, we're going to put the floodlights on. So they obviously had it planned. I think they knew that if it went beyond maybe two holes, that the floodlights were going to be needed. And that's exactly what happened.
It's an extraordinary place. Now, you're obviously there, John. Can you explain a little bit about it? Because the golf course has got these amazing trees, and as I said last week, it's a golf course Mike Clayton probably wouldn't like, but it is an incredible place with all these floodlights throughout the entire course, pretty much.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a massive resort that we're in the middle of. There's about, I'm not sure how many courses there are, at least four or five in the vicinity. So it's where people come, they come for a week. There was a bunch of guys from my hometown in Scotland. I bumped into them this afternoon. They're here until Friday, and they're going to play, I think, a different course every day. So that's the kind of place it is. You come here and you play golf and you get a nice variety.
So what was the atmosphere like? We were talking about this before the ad break, before you came on, about it looked good on television. And I just wonder whether as golf tries these, you know, new things, new formats to sort of engage potentially with some of the younger audience, whether there's something in this moving forward of playing under lights?
Well, it's been done before. I think Tiger played a couple of exhibition-type things back in the day under lights in America. So it's not, you know, 100% new, but it's certainly something that the, you know, golf should certainly investigate every possibility. I mean, my goodness, the game is supposedly shrinking all over the world, so anything they can do to, you know, get new audiences involved is got to be a good thing.
Did it look good if you're around the 18th hole, looking back down towards the tee?
Yeah. I mean, there was a good atmosphere. I mean, there was a good crowd. There's more. I've been to this tournament a few times, and this was the biggest crowd I've ever seen. So, in that, you know, sense, it was a step in the right direction. But, the atmosphere was terrific. The people were into it. And, I think this, you know, it's easy to poo-poo people playing the same hole over and over, but it was actually quite exciting because it was a par five that they could reach in two if they hit the fairway. And so it came down, you know, there's lots of drama. It was, I found it, you know, pretty exciting, to be honest.
Henderson. Oh, it's delicious, Chris Murray! Liverpool are pulling away. This may be an irreversible lead on the day and through the campaign.
What did you expect? What did you expect when Man City went to Liverpool? They were way too good again. 3-1, as the record suggests. It was always going to be a challenge for City to get the job done. They were unable to do it. Liverpool continue on their merry way at the top of the English Premier League. Russell Milton would have been watching it all unfold, I'm sure, our UK correspondent. Russ, good morning.
Good morning, Half. How are you?
Going very well, thank you. Of course they were going to smack them 3-1. That's what they do at Anfield.
One defeat in 45. I thought, unbeaten in 45 at Anfield, Liverpool. So, you know, incredible record. And only one defeat in their last 50 Premier League games. So it was always going to be after City. First things first, it was a fantastic game. And normally these games don't live up to their height and billion, but this one was fantastic. The quality and intensity in the game was superb. And City actually had the better chances, I would say, overall. Liverpool were more clinical. And City, at the end, the last 15, 20 minutes, came right back into it. And, yeah, they scored one, but could have had two or three quite easily. But Liverpool were fantastic and really pounced on Man City's mistakes, as they have done. And, you know, there were some fantastic goals. Fabinho's strike from 25 yards. The two crosses for the second and the third goals were you know, you'll do well to see better all season. And then, you know, they could have had one or two more themselves. You know, it was a great game, great advert for the Premier League. And, you know, long may that continue. But as you say, yeah, Liverpool win. They're 8 points clear of Leicester and Chelsea and 9 points clear of Man City.
They are dominating at the moment. What is it about Anfield? Now, we know there's been some great Liverpool teams over the journey and all that. And we talk about home field advantage a lot in the world of sport, or home court, or whatever sport you are talking about. But Liverpool, City's record at Anfield is one win from 23 appearances. One from 23. What is it about Anfield? Because they've been great through the journey of City in the last couple of years.
Yeah, City have been fantastic, haven't they? You know, 100 points and 98 points in the last two seasons. But, yeah, Liverpool's a real tough place to go. Even you know, when Liverpool haven't been so good and have been sort of languishing in fifth and sixth place in various seasons gone by, it's still a tough place to go. It's one of those that, you know, the fans generate a lot of passion, a lot of noise. It's just the history behind the place. You know, the European nights they have are well-renowned, and it just seems to give the players an extra 5-10%, and, you know, they certainly make it count. And I think on this occasion today, it was really good. You know, we go back last season, and Barcelona went there, didn't they, to Liverpool. It was 3-0 up. Everybody thought the tie was over. But I know Jurgen Klopp's really bought into the place and really got it going again, and like the olden days, and, you know, they turned that around and won 4-0. So, yes, they can beat anyone. I think they're probably up there with one of the best sides in the world at the minute. They're probably the best. And City are obviously there, but City have just come off a couple of percent. Liverpool's incentive, obviously, last year was that they only lost one game and still didn't win the league. So I think that, you know, Jurgen Klopp must have said at the end of last season, right, let's go for it. Let's up our game a bit. City have dropped theirs, and, you know, you're seeing the results of it now. But Anfield is one of those special grounds, and long may that continue, because it's, you know, rightfully at the top in world football.
Well, it's an amazing performance, 3-1. As you say, at this stage of the season, I'm not sure we've had two off and someone this far ahead, the 8 points. Does it, Does it make it hard? We know there's a heap of the season still to go, clearly, but does it make it hard for anyone to get hold of them, or do they have the capacity to just relax and collapse, or what do you think of the season that might come upon us?
Yeah. Well, you would think that, it's Liverpool's, we're sort of just about a third of the way through the season. Yes, there's a long way to go, 26 games, but, barring some freak results, I think a load of injuries. I'm sure that Jurgen Klopp won't let the players drop in intensity. Their game is based on that. They're really fit. So I can't see Liverpool dropping off. There's a three-game swing at the minute that Liverpool have got to lose and the others have got to win. So it's a real tough ask for Leicester, Chelsea, Man City, who are the three behind, to pick that up. So I would say, barring any major catastrophes, I think, we could quite rightly say this is Liverpool's really to throw away now. So they've been fantastic and, would be great champions for the Premier League.
England, can you do it? Can you break their hearts again? It's a tie!
No! No,
it's a tie!
Goal! Would you believe it?
Poor old Ian Smith. You got a feel for Ian Smith. The World Cup wasn't bad enough. They go on home soil, and all of a sudden it happens again, and the great man himself is good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Ian, how are you coping?
Yeah, wow. I had a few beers. I couldn't believe it, actually. Here I am working with Hussein again, and it happens all over again. It's like, wow, you can't. Some things just won't leave you. So there's so many similarities. That's what got me about it. There's just absolutely so many similarities about the numbers involved, the players involved. It was spooky, really spooky.
So for those playing at home, the match was tied after the end of regulation. As we like to say, the Super Over happened and England won again like they did in the World Cup final. Was it? Because the funny thing I found, Ian, now it's not funny clearly for you guys, but the funny thing I found was at the venue yesterday, they were giving away commemorative ties, which said it was a tie between New Zealand and England in the World Cup final. And you get that on the day, you get another one.
I know. As I said, I just couldn't believe that that could happen again that soon. I mean, the very next crucial game that we play, the very next final situation, it comes down to that. And it's very hard to explain, but I found myself... Well, I was looking out the window at Eden Park, but I think out of the corner of my eye was St. Lord's all over. Same result, even though it was more comfortable this time around. Our guys weren't able to handle the pressure when it came to the absolute crunch. But, hey, look, wonderful series. It bodes well, actually, because the T20 World Cup's in your neck of the woods in around about 12 months' time. So those two teams will be ready for it.
In regulation, you mentioned... Chris Jordan went berserk in the last over. What happened? Hitting a four off the last ball. What was Jimmy Neesham bowling to him?
Well, a pie, really. A pie. And believe me, I know a bit about pies. It was a pie. Look, it's waist time. A knee-high full toss on leg stump. Oh. To be fair, Chris Jordan was fuming that he didn't hit it out of the ground. And Eden Park, the boundary down where he hit it is around about 53 metres, so... Strong guy like that, all he had to do was get a bit of elevation and we wouldn't have to go through that drama. But and that's another reason why I think that fate just looked at it and thought, why not? Let's have another go and torment these guys once more. So it was poor. Jimmy Neesham's execution in terms of where he had to bowl that delivery was bad. It was very poor. And then it came to the batting side of things and we didn't handle it well either there. So, look, hey, look. No complaints about the end result. It was just the drama involved. We weren't playing for a world title, but it felt like it.
And it was controversy in the Super Over. The keeper took the first ball for you guys, Tim?
Yeah, there's controversy there. There was another marginal wide, as there was in the World Cup. I think Joffre Archer was bowling in the World Cup, and the first ball he bowled was a marginal wide, signalled wide. Again, we had another situation where there was another wide signalled. And that was marginal as well. There was just so many similarities. Archer wasn't playing, but his closest mate in England cricket is Chris Jordan. And Chris Jordan was. So we sent out Martin Guptill, of course, the torment of Martin Guptill in the World Cup. We thought there was an opportunity for him to just get rid of a few demons, but he wasn't able to when it came to the crunch. And, wow, another opportunity, but... I sat down, I had a drink with Nessa last night, actually, Nessa Sane, and we just talked about just how similar the whole deal was just a few months later.
Is it overcomplicating to say that there is some scarring still from the World Cup that might be around for a while, or is it just a coincidence?
No, I think it's scarring. It's got to be scarring. You know, I mean, if you've been around sport, you've played international sport, whatever. I mean, if you've been around any sort of crucial decision you have to make in life and that doesn't go right for you, it scars you. And you know, to think that that was a timely or an untimely reminder of just of what had gone on, I'm sure a lot of the New Zealand players in particular who were on the receiving end two times in a row would have sat down last night in the dressing room and thought, man, you know, are we over this thing or not? I'm not sure. In a World Cup situation, I played in 1992. We got beaten in the semi-final, and I thought we were a shot side to go on and make that final at the MCG way, way, way back then. That still haunts me. And that was a semi-final. And we were beaten pretty comprehensively in the end by Pakistan, so there's no doubt about it. But to lose a World Cup final when your numbers are the same as their numbers, but their name's on the trophy, you go to a situation where it's decided by a bizarre rule of who hits the most boundaries. I ask you guys this question. On the morning of the World Cup final, did Owen Morgan and Kane Williamson stand up in front of their players and say, listen, fellas, this is the World Cup final. Let's hit lots of fours just in case the super over ends in a tie. I don't think so. So here we go. They've changed the rule because of that and say they should have. But we go through that similar scenario yesterday. The good thing about yesterday, had we had to go to another situation where it was a tie, we'd have gone again, which is, of course, what should have happened at Lord's.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. And I'm interested, we talked to Simon Doole about this last week, about how many good England players were left at home for this series. Did it upset the New Zealand team? Did it upset the New Zealand public that they weren't sending their best players?
I don't think so. The numbers were pretty good. It was a poor crowd yesterday, but that was, I think, weather-driven. Throughout the country and the provinces, because this is really early for us to be playing cricket, you know, like November, this is super early for us. So to get the crowds that we had throughout, I think was okay. I think the response was good. There was, of course, the World Cup memory that brought these two sides back together so quickly. But, look, they're a good side, England. Make no bones about it. And in 12 months' time, as I said, when they're playing in that, you add Stokes into that, you add Ruth into that, you add Archer, Butler, these guys, you're going to have one hell of a side, English side, and they are learning how to play around the world, and Morgan is ruthless, and he just wants another title that he can hold up. So, hey, they're good. We're not quite as good as him, I don't believe, but, you know, I think we're coming to see you very shortly, and we're going to have fun.
Silent Sovereign whacking away. Vegas Jewel presents it. Here's Miami Bound. Oliver has it moved. Then Gamay behind them from Beauty Bold and Song Brocade at the 300 metres. Miami Bound lets down and takes Vegas Jewel, trying to go with her. Miami Bound drifting out towards the centre, kicks away two or three. Vegas Jewel, Never Listen Late with Moonlight Made. Miami Bound in front, 100 metres to go. She's toughing it out. She's won the Oaks for Damien Oliver. Miami Bound wins it by 3 lengths.
She brained him is what she did. Absolutely brained him in the VRC Oaks. The Kennedy Oaks did Miami Bound, and it was part of a massive week for Damien Oliver, who just continues to dominate proceedings at the Melbourne Cup Carnival. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Ollie, good morning. Congratulations.
Thanks very much, Harf.
It was a great week for you. You started with a derby win on Warning. You get the Oaks win with Miami Bound. You're a classics specialist, it seems.
Yeah, I'll take a derby and an Oaks in a week any time.
We're going into the spring, Ollie. Were you pretty confident that these two, particularly for the Melbourne Cup Carnival perspective, were going to be absolutely prominent?
Yeah, early doors, I thought Miami Bound was really one for the Oaks. We lost a little bit of confidence when she got beat at Flemington and Caulfield, but she was still hanging in there. But those two runs, I think, just seasoned her up really well for when she did get back to Flemington for the 2000, and she hit peak form at the right time. And Warning, that was one that sort of came a little bit late, but he had great Flemington form, and he did run really well in the lead-up at Caulfield, so getting back to Flemington really suited him as well, I think.
When you are riding and you get those winners early in the carnival, do you get confidence from that? Do you ride on confidence as much as experience?
It certainly helps, yeah. You sort of target yourself, if you like, to try and peak on these bigger days. and, you know, you put a lot of hard work in probably July, coming into August, riding a lot around the country and building the relationships and trying to find the really nice horses that are coming through, because sometimes those maidens come July and August, they can be really hot races, and they're the horses that are, you know, could be peaking later in the spring.
Damien, I noticed you were very emotional, particularly on the Saturday winning, and I know you won in those famous Freedman colours, but it just seemed that it was a bit, I don't know whether it was a bit more in it for you this year, but I was surprised how emotional you were.
Yeah, I suppose breaking the all-time record for the most winners at Flemington is a pretty nostalgic and big feat, I suppose. You know, there's 150 years of history at Flemington, and to think, you know, and some really famous names and jockeys come before me, so to think that you're the one that's ridden the most is, it probably hit home for me a little bit. And I think as you get a little bit older too and have family and kids, you do get a little bit more emotional. So, yeah, I was probably a little bit more emotional than I normally am.
Yeah, and what keeps you going? Because you've been doing it for so long now at the highest level, and we get all excited when we see a cricketer or a tennis player or a footballer, you know, go for 10 years. You've been doing it for nearly 30 at the highest level. What gets you out of bed in the morning to keep doing
There's probably not one thing, but I suppose doing it from a young age, you know, most apprentice jockeys start when they're 15, and it does become a little bit of a way of life, and with the prize money so big and strong at the moment, it's a hard thing to give up, and I still enjoy it as well. I mean, I love the thrill of the competition, and you know, it's a little bit different every day going to work to ride a horse, and it's a bit of an adrenaline rush most of the time as well too. I mean, like any job, it has its days when it's you know, it becomes a bit monotonous at times, but you know, you got to go through those moments to enjoy the really exciting moments as well.
Well, is there a sense of relief even getting to Flemington in a way? Because there's so much pressure, and you've experienced, you get a suspension at Caulfield or Moonee Valley and it wipes out Flemington. What's that sort of period leading into it, those couple of weeks?
Yeah, it's a big build-up because, as I said, I mean, a lot of the preparation comes from July and August, and it's a long build-up to the time you actually get to Flemington. So you just got to be aware, you got to pace yourself a little bit, and as you said, not get suspended, because that can really interrupt your momentum coming into those big weeks if you've done all the work early and then miss a couple of key rides and a couple of winners. And sometimes you're a little bit, you could be out of mind, out of sight very quickly. So you've got to time your run, so to speak, and be hitting form at the right time. And hopefully it all comes together come Melbourne Cup week. And, you know, same time too, you don't want to be maybe doing too much or working too hard and getting flat, being flat by the time the big week comes around. So I suppose over a long period of time doing it and having made a few mistakes over my career in the timing side of things, when you get it right, it's certainly all worthwhile, and it can be a great week for you, cup week.
What is it about Flemington? I mean, we watch it, we punt there. I mean, it's the bigger track, you get more chance. Is that why you love it so much compared to other tracks?
I mean, obviously you get the huge crowds there, and it's only that one week of the year that you do get those big crowds. Unfortunately, the weather wasn't really kind to us this year, but, yeah, I mean, all the best horses tend to come there that week and peak that week, and, you know, although with Sydney Carnival clashing a little bit with it now, but, you know, you get all the best riders and trainers and jockeys and horses there, so it's a culmination of, you know, everyone coming together, and hopefully if you can get a big result on one of those big days, it really is fantastic.
Good diving header. Coulomb has never scored in the A-League. Kumi! That's a way to silence the doubters! Kwabena Kumi puts Western United in front!
Kwabena Kumi scoring for Western United yesterday. In fact, it was the match winner against West Sydney Wanderers down at GMHBA Stadium. 2-1 to the newest team in town. And Cabsy's been good enough to join us. Good morning!
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. So we haven't spoken to you before in the program. We haven't spoken to many of your teammates because you're a new club, in fairness. But it's great to have you with us. A performance like that yesterday, West Sydney Wanderers have had some great performances through the last couple of years in the A-League. You guys are a new team in town. You've got a new stadium with a new fan base you're trying to engage. How important are wins like that for your team yesterday?
Yeah, very important. You know, it shows, you know, we've got, you know, great team character and team spirit. And, you know, obviously, you know, the fans, you know, enjoy that win on the weekend. And, you know, hopefully we can get more fans along on the road.
And no one knows the Wanderers better than you. You spent like 4 years there through your time in the A-League. You've spent time at Central Coast, Newcastle as well. You've seen a fair bit of this competition. And now you're at a new team. What's it been like getting to a new franchise?
Yeah, well, I think the second signing at Western Sydney Wanderers when it first formed back in 2012. So I know a lot about you know, new franchises. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit difficult, you know, to obviously you know, get everything off up and running, you know, at the start, you know, at the start of the season. But you know, with this new team here, Western United, you know, I think, you know, we've done that. You know, we've shown a lot of team spirit, which is, you know, very, you know, very rare to find in a new team, you know, especially at the start. And, you know, I think we've got, you know, a good opportunity to, you know, do something great in the competition.
And you came in to replace Basaat Berisha, who was rested.
Yeah, that's a big a big ask. You know, he's the all-time leading goal scorer in the league, I think. So, you know, obviously, it's, you know, it's great that the boss, you know, put a lot of faith in me to be able to, you know, replace best for the game. And, you know, hopefully I repaid, you know, his faith by obviously scoring the winner.
What have you learned, or just being close to Bess, you know, for the last couple of months leading into the start of the season? I mean, as you said, he's one of the greats of this league.
Yeah, obviously he's a real winner. You know, he's got a lion mentality. You know, everything on and off the pitch, you know, he has to win. You know, and that's, you know, a great characteristic to have. You know, on and off the pitch. And, you know, obviously I'm, you know, just trying to, you know, learn off him to, you know, obviously be that beast in the 6 yard box that he is.
We talked to Scotty McDonald last week and said, you know, are you surprised with the start? And he said, oh, not necessarily. Our team's not bad. What about yourself? What were you thinking going into the season compared to where you're at now?
I've only been here, I think, this is my fifth week. You know, I came the week the season started. So, you know, I wasn't, you know, here, you know, for pre-season to be able to, you know, see what the expectations were. But obviously from day one, you know, the boss's expectations are really high, which is, you know, very good for, you know, all the players in the squad. And, you know, I've been here for 5 weeks and, you know, there's a lot of improvement still to go, which is, you know, the most exciting part about it. So, yeah.
Can you explain that journey to our listeners who don't quite understand how you only turned up 2 minutes before start time?
Best ever, no pre-season.
I got the call. I think, you know, the week before the season starts to come down, and you know, I came, and you know, only a few sessions with the team, and you know, I found myself on the plane to Wellington.
Well, it's a great story, and the fact that you were able to get that one in yesterday. I mean, you get that ball coming to the box late in the game, or for the winner yesterday. You do a little turn, you get it onto the left foot, and you kick it into the bottom right hand corner. Was that where you were aiming?
Yeah, well, no, I was actually aiming for the, you know, across the keeper. But, you know, obviously when the ball came at that speed, you know, I was hoping that the touch would be perfect to set it up. And it just fell straight for me.
The Victorian cricket team has a match starting tomorrow against the Queensland Bulls at the MCG. They're back at the MCG and they need a positive result. Pete Hanscom is just the man for that sort of role. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Pete.
Morning, guys.
How's things going within the camp there at the old Bush Rangers?
No, the camp's fine, mate. The boys are all up and about. You know, we're a good bunch, and we know what we need to do going forward. So that's the plan this game, and hopefully get a win on the board.
How do things change with a new coach? We had a chat to Lockie last week, but how does it change from a playing perspective?
Not a great deal from a playing perspective. Andrew McDonald was very good at having a player driven team, and Lockie's very similar as well. So the onus is on the players to do the research and get what they need, which is how we've been running it for the last few years. So no, Lockie will step in seamlessly, and he's a good lad as well, so that helps.
And tell us about this debutante that we're going to be seeing, this 17-year-old wonder kid, Jake Fraser-McGurk. What do we get from him?
Well, we get a shocking haircut to start with.
I was just going to say that.
Pretty terrible there, but that's just the next generation coming through. You can't do much about that. But no, he, He looks good. He's you can tell he's kind of been watching Steve Smith as he grows up. So there's a few little nuances in there that are a bit similar, and hopefully he can go out and replicate that. But he's a good player. He's a good kid, and pretty excited to see what he's got for us.
And he can bowl leggies, Pete.
And he can bowl leggies. Yeah, he bowled a couple in the nets yesterday, and they were turning square. So he could sneak a cheeky over in here or there.
Well, you and Marcus bowled down the Junction Oval, so anything's possible, Pete.
Oh yeah, mate. If he was playing that game, he would have bowled about 30 overs.
Hey, just about the MCG pitch, because I think that's going to be one of the real interests going into the game tomorrow. Have you had a sneaky look? Have you had a chat to Matt Page? Do you know what you're going to get?
Yeah, I had a look at it yesterday. It's got a nice even covering of grass on it. So Pagey was hoping that that grass will stay live for the game and hopefully offer some seam movement throughout all the innings. So, fingers crossed it does, because we need a result, and, he's pretty confident. He's happy with the way the square's looking this year. So, it could be a bit of a different pitch that we see this year, which is nice.
Your batting is obviously going to be tested because of the players that aren't playing. You get Aaron Finch back, which helps. But with your bowling, it looks like that's going to be your strength. Will you play five bowlers, or are you still not sure?
Still not sure what direction we're going there with the bowlers. Got to talk to the chairman this afternoon. It was a Sunday yesterday, so he took the day off. we'll have a discussion this afternoon and see what direction we go down. But either way, we've got a class. A pretty strong bowling attack, and hopefully they'll get the 20 wickets that we need.
And James Patterson, he's right to go. Where's he at preparation-wise for this game?
He's flying, mate. He didn't want to miss the last game. So his body's strong. He just wants to keep playing every possible game that he's available for. So he'll come out and bowl the house down.
And this thought, Will Sutherland might finally get his Shield debut. Can you take us through his improvement? I mean, he's shown a lot in the white ball.
Yeah, I think the one-day comp's been really, really good for Sutho. I mean, it shows that he can compete at this level, and hopefully that's given him, a lot of self-belief going forward as well. So if he does get this opportunity tomorrow, hopefully he grabs it with both hands.
Pete, can I ask you about the Nick Maddison situation, not necessarily the specifics, but we've seen a bit of recent times that players are taking time out to deal with some issues off the field. How much of that do you think is the continual nature of the rolling calendar of cricket, that it just becomes overwhelming and difficult to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, it can be tough. Cricket being a 12-month-a-year game now, that you can see a bit of burnout starting to come into players, and it is hard to stay up for such long periods of time. So the stress comes in, and credit to both Maxi and Maddo that they've actually had the strength to step up and talk about it and say they weren't right and go and get the help that's required. So that just shows really strong characters.
The Australian public have got behind the Matildas. They are absolutely our favourite national sporting team, I reckon, these days. And they put on a bit of a show yesterday as well in Parramatta at Bankwest Stadium. 2-1 was the scoreline in their match against Chile. And Lydia Williams was watching it all unfold from the keeper's box with the gloves on. Lydia, good morning.
Morning. How are you?
We are going very well, thank you. Just on, before we get to the game itself, your place in the Australian sporting landscape, the Matildas, do you think, like I do, that you are the most popular Australian team these days?
I mean, obviously there's a bunch of teams that are, paving the way for Australian sports. But, I have a bit of bias and I love the team. I love, the fact that all the girls put themselves out there in a really personal way. We've gone from strength to strength over the past, 5 years. And, it's really exciting to see what the future holds.
Well, you're coming off the World Cup through the middle of the year, and you got a couple of friendlies against Chile, 2-1 yesterday, and you get 20,000 people at Bankwest Stadium in Parramatta. How does that make you feel?
Oh, it's incredible. You know, when we first had the games, I think it was against Brazil, and we packed out those stadiums, and each year we keep breaking records. It's just incredible to see the public and how much Australian fans love football and love women's football. And, yeah, it's really touching.
Ali, Sam Kerr mentioned after the game that it was a bit like blowing out the cobwebs. You guys hadn't been together since the World Cup?
Yeah, everyone's kind of been doing their own thing for a while, and this was our first real get-together since then. So, yeah, I mean, we've only really had 4 days of work together before we played the game to go over some new things. So it was actually, you know, a little bit of cobwebs and I think a little bit of new style that we're hoping to adapt into our, I guess, future games.
I mentioned Sam Kerr. What's it like from your position watching her?
Oh, it's incredible.
It's a long way away.
No, but you watch her score a lot.
Yeah, you just let her run and do her own thing. There's angles that she does that are like, I'm like, okay, cool. And then, you know, she scores at the back of the net. It's been amazing watching her play for both club and country, and I'm glad she's on our team.
And what about the fact you're talking about on your team, 20,000 turn up, there's just this real emotional attachment to the Matildas. This isn't about a men's team or a women's team. This is an Australian team that people have got right behind. How do you feel about that?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I think right from, you know, 2015 when we were at that World Cup and made history there, I think ever since then the public's just kind of, I guess, fallen in love with us. And, you know, all of us take risks. All of us, we put ourselves out there and want to play not only for the sport, but for each other in the country. And I think, you know, that's kind of been the main focus and why, I guess, you know, we have so many supporters out there.
Yeah, and you talked to them before about being, you know, taking the game on. Is that part of it, that you play such an entertaining brand of football? Or is that just a byproduct of winning?
I think we're risk takers, and all of us have been able to adapt from different styles and over the years, different coaches and players that we've been playing with. And I think, you know, we're very adaptable. We're very personable. And you can see every game that we play, we leave it all out on the field. There's not a, you know, single ounce of energy that's not spent or emotion that's not kept in. And, you know, I don't think anyone can fault our efforts when we play.
So, Lydia, what's our program? We've got the Olympic qualifiers next year. What's our short-term program for you guys?
Well, we have our W League, so everyone will kind of be heading off to that. It actually starts this upcoming weekend, so we'll be doing that and then hopefully maybe get a small camp in before we go to our Olympic qualifiers. But it's quite difficult to get together as a national team during our W League season and if there's no FIFA windows.
Well, that's good business. The W League's going from strength to strength. We want all their good players. Now, Sam's not going to be playing. She's been in the US tournament or the competition for the last little while. How important is it to try and get her back and your best players back playing in the W League so the sport does continue to grow, Lydia?
Yeah, we want to obviously continue to grow the W League, but we also want all of our players playing in the best competition they can to better themselves. You know, Sam's been going back-to-back, I think, for quite a number of years. So now she's decided to go on to a challenge, which is, you know, great for her. It helps our national team. Obviously, we'd love to see her back in Australia, but at the end of the day, we want to win medals for the national team. And whatever we need to do that, I think, that's going to be the next focus.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.